Now we have Susan Jeffcott in our studios here. Welcome, Susan.
Hi.
And Susan is an artist, but she's decided to branch out to do something new with stuff that is maybe not so new, because
for years
you have been writing stories around Christmas time. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, it all started out writing letters to Lionel, my departed husband, writing letters to his mother. And then people wanted copies of the letters. And then we... So he started writing them, and then I started writing, and we each wrote a page, and one thing led to another. And then at Christmas, I decided, after that we had a readership of about 80 people reading these letters, all over the like England, France, and so on, you know, and here in Canada. And so then I started, as a Christmas present, writing a Christmas story based on something that might have happened to myself. So I kind of took that as an idea, but I kind of changed it, because we used, as Lionel used to say, you shouldn't let the truth stand in the way of a good story.
Absolutely.
So
I know that we here at The Review don't. We just make it all up.
Anyway, so that's what I did. I started writing these little stories just for fun, and I kind of enjoyed it, because you get to make people say stuff that they'd never say. And it was great fun and kind of sense of freedom and so on. And so I do that, and I sent them out every Christmas. Eventually I ran out of Christmas stories, events of my own self. So then I invented other storylines or something with our cat and so on. And it just grew from there. And I've been doing it since about 1980 or so. I don't know. And however long that is, 20, 30, 40 years. So there's a lot of stories,
years, yeah.
A lot of the stories. And so I've put together, and people used to say to me, like, gee, Susan, you know, you should put these together. Or why don't you just write a story and illustrate it? And I go, oh, sounds like homework, you know? So.
But you've kept these over the years. And now, you have 25 stories that you're going to have in your book.
That's right. I picked out the ones I thought were, you know, the ones I liked the best. And I picked them out, and I guess I was inspired because I saw Louise's thing in the paper, and I thought, well, this doesn't look like too much work. Mm-hmm. Someone else is going to do all the thing, and because I have friends that are writers, and they say, you're going to do this and that, and of course, if you're going to get published with a commercial publisher, you got to convince them, and it sounded like nightmare, so I prefer to paint, so.
Right.
And so I put them together and chose those ones, and some of them have been edited by myself and some of them edited with the help of my neighbor, Eunice, because I used to read them out loud to her. And when it got confusing, she'd say, stop, back up, or, you know, like things like that, or that was confusing, or you've done that too many times, and I would correct them. And sometimes I'd rewrite a story 5 times, sometimes it would just work and write it in 2, you know. And as long as I could read them out loud and not stumble too badly over the words, I figured they were okay. And I had fun doing it. And as long as they make you laugh or cry, that's what it's
yes.
about.
how is it? How do you find it compared to painting? I mean, how long have you been painting?
Since I was 12, so. It's like, I don't know what her 12 is from 77.
But is writing, this is just kind of a little whimsical things that come out of your mind? Is painting more of an effort, or is painting sort of the same?
Well, painting actually can come from different things, but basically it comes from inside, and it's just something will twick my mind. I'll see something, and it will make me think of something, or I'll wake up from a dream, and I'll have an image, or there'll be something happening and I will feel very strongly and images will come to me at night and I will put that down. Sometimes it's just the slimmest little image, you know, a cat walking across the street, a stone, you know, a song, a mood, a color.
And have you always painted in the style that you paint now? Have you always painted that way?
Well, it sort of has changed over time. I used to work in oils. Actually, I started painting as early as 3 years old. not painting, but drawing on the bottoms of my parents' chairs. You know, you turn the chair over and there's an original Jeffcott. But I got my, I'll say 12, because that's when my grandmother gave me my first set of oils. And I used oils right up until 1965. And then I got introduced to acrylics by a couple of friends, and I liked that because you could paint on paper. And so I did that, and then I started painting on Masonite, and then I met Lionel. And then we were moving from house to house, and he said, you know, I think you should paint on canvas. These things are really heavy. So... But when I'm writing, I can't paint. I can't do this both. I thought I could, but I discovered I can't. So when I can't, I'm in a situation where I can't paint, I can write. And I've always been writing, actually, when I think about it, since my, about 12, 10 or 12, I guess 12, maybe a bit later, my mother got a typewriter. And it was so neat to, you know, type a printed word that would made it look true.
Look like a real book or something.
It will make, if you printed a poem, like I used to write poetry, you know, sort of angsty teenager stuff, and you'd see it printed on the paper. Well, that made it somehow real. And I used to torture my family by reading them these poems, which they didn't want to hear. Anyways, so I guess I've written since things, you know, verbal diarrhea stuff. And
I've read some of your stories, and I think people are really going to love them. And they're simple. They're kind of almost, I call them almost children's stories, but not. And they're really fun to read. Really fun to read.
Well, thank you. I wondered what you would think, you know, because you're kind of outside my milieu, and you don't know. If you're sending people a story in a letter and they're saying, oh, that's great, and stuff like that, is it because they're being polite? You know, you don't know if they really like it. Though some people, I thought it was genuine. And actually, some people then they pass them on to other people. That's why I signed the bottom, because I suddenly realized I could lose a story and I could end up watching it on television or something, you know.
Yes.
But...
And we should say that I'm actually, the review is working on your book, which is called The Tangerine Cat.
Right.
And so I'm just doing the graphic design, and I'm helping, there's a whole unknown world of writers in this community, people who have written books years ago, and they're all... It's they're all coming to life. It's like zombies that are coming to life, but they're good zombies.
Yeah.
And your stories all have kind of a connective... I don't know, there's a commonality. I guess it's because they're written by you, but they have that, and I can only kind of guess that it's something, it's almost like, that's why I was asking you about your pictures. Your pictures have kind of a...
They're always
otherworldly. Me. They're always you, but there's something, they're happening, but almost in a parallel universe or something, but they have a kind of interesting quality.
Universe, and that's where it comes from, really, you know? I mean, we just slip through the cracks every so often into that other world, you know? And the only problem is that you've got to realize which one you're in. You get locked up. But no, look, I've done that. Because I used to keep diaries. And that was part of my verbal diarrhea. But then that was private. And, you know, dream diary, then a cooking diary. And then I used to kind of fool around with parapsychology, and I kept that diary. Then I stopped keeping that diary because I didn't want people to read that. So I got rid of all that. And
that's the thing. If you write diaries, you have to think, where are these going to end up? But I think people don't write diaries anymore because they put everything on Facebook.
Yeah.
People are living on Facebook, and they're not talking to themselves, I think, anymore.
Yeah. Well, some, you know... If somebody reads something that I've written and they don't like it, well, tough, close the book. Simple. And if somebody has something nasty to say about my writing, well, fine, you know, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? I'm sorry you don't like it. It's just like I've had people walk into my exhibitions of work and it triggered something and they absolutely hate it. And like... I remember one woman saying to her husband, get me out of here, get me out of here. But that was a success because obviously what you've put down is you've touched something. Mm-hmm. And therefore you have succeeded in actual fact because you've, you know, And I think the same thing with the book, unless it's badly written, I suppose. I don't know, because this is my first time doing something and throwing it out to the great unwashed, you know.
But that's what they say about art and paintings, is that everyone, it's something in you, but when people look at your art or your writing, they're interpreting it and they're reading it. It becomes their story, so two different people can get quite a different take on a piece of art, for example.
That's right. And, you know, people have seen things in my paintings that I haven't seen myself, and maybe these stories will do something or trigger something. And I've had people phone me, like, you know, from France and stuff, from England, saying how much they liked it. Certain ones, or, you know, a cousin phoned up one time and just said, like, what are you doing to my head? She was so, you know, reacting to it. And the couple of them I read, was rereading them, getting ready for this. And I was touched all over again. I thought, well, isn't that funny, you know? And I guess it's still, but then, you know, I'm biased because it's my own story, but I was feeling a little lump in the throat and going, oh my goodness. Or maybe I was just, you know, that was the mood of the day, you know. But I have to say it's fun, and this is very exciting for me.
Yeah, it's kind of, I tell people when they bring their material in or they come to meet me the first time that it's kind of like a seesaw, that sometimes the work is on you, and then sometimes it comes back to us in production, and then it kind of seesaws back and forth until it's all completed.
Right.
And you'll always have that golden moment when you walk out and you've left everything here and you think, ah, now it's their problem, you know?
Yeah.
And that's because at the beginning I'm saying, well, we need this, we need this, we need this, and we need the other thing. But, you know, something I wanted to ask you, and I've known you for a long time, not as long as maybe some of your long, long time friends, but, you know, everybody in this town kind of has their role and their place. And I've always wondered what it is like. You are kind of like our resident artist. I mean, you dress a little differently. You wear these big necklaces. You always have, you know, this nice kind of floaty clothing, and you kind of walk down the street. I mean, if you're way at the other end of the street and I'm at this end, I know that that's you. Like, you're such a familiar figure in this town.
Wow.
You've painted a mural here. Everybody knows who you are. You have your house, which is painted inside in such vivid colors. It's like walking into one of your paintings. It's like you live in one of your paintings.
That's what Lionel said after the fire. I said, trust me and just let me do it. And I set up the whole floor plan of the house as in squares, and then I did it like a Modrian painting, and I just balanced all the colors, and when the color didn't go, I didn't use it, and that was...
I know, and you've got the black and white checkered floors. It's like walking into... I know you took me on a tour when you had just restored everything and put
all
it back,
right,
and you
yeah.
were... I remember vividly you showing me the pink room upstairs or an orange room and saying, well, look at the light in the corner and look at the light over there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that was an eye opener for me. And I realized, yes, you can have one color in here, but it changes
colors.
And it's many colors. It depends where you're looking.
That was called Dubloon Orange. Yeah.
The which?
Dubloon Orange, I think it was. Or Dubloon Yellow. I think that was in John's room.
Okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, there's so many colors within colors that people don't realize it, that... it's neat when somebody sees it.
Right.
I get very excited when people see colors.
You were saying you see colors a bit differently. What were you telling me about that?
That's images. I see the
images. Okay.
I never... Lionel called it a limbic screw-up thing, limbic lobe screw-up kind of thing, that my eyes don't always see things the way other people do, and I have to wait for my eyes to sort of organize themselves so I can see things. It depends how tired I am or something like that. But I can look at something and it will start to wobble and so on. And if I let my imagination go, it'll change into something else. You know, on people's faces, and I can look at people's faces and they start to change. And if I'm thinking a color, you can see a color. And I think everybody can do this if they just close their eyes, relax, and you look through your eyelids, and at first you'll see sort of orange like that, you know?
Yeah, why does that happen?
Okay.
I know exactly what you
that's
mean.
That's because the lights are the orange. If you're looking near the sun, it'll be light orange. But anyways, as you have your eyes closed and you relax, and then you'll notice that colors are welling up from the bottom like this. I'm waving
it's
my
like
hands
It's like a kaleidoscope, but it's psychedelic.
But the thing is, think of a color, and that color will appear. Hmm. And as... And sometimes if you practice long enough, the color will appear almost before you think of it. And if you have seen yellow and you think green, it will change to green. And it's amazing. And that's kind of one of the experiments I was doing. And then the thing is you try and it's very nebulous. It's sort of like this, you know, sort of wavily. And then what you've got to do is consolidate the edges and make that into a triangle or a square. And that's usually when you get a headache. But this is called visualization. And then you do that. And then what you do is you practice doing it with your eyes open. And you look at a blank wall, that yellow wall, and you're going to look at that yellow wall. And if you look at it, you'll notice the yellow starts moving around and it's going to start changing color. If you're thinking white, it's going to get lighter. And if you're thinking green, it's going to get green patches on top of the light.
Yeah, it turns blue.
Right. Well, we all see colors differently, but it's amazing because it's a fluid thing. I don't know how to explain it because I'm not a scientist, but that's just sort of one of the kind of magical things I like to do.
But we went off on a really colorful tangent there.
Yeah, but, sorry.
But no, that was interesting. But what I was asking you about being in this town, that do you feel like a singular person, or do you just feel like this is where you live and this is who I am and I'm just like everybody else?
I feel, I guess I always feel special. I don't want to use the word singular because that sort of sounds sort of negative, kind of hostile, kind of. Sometimes if I'm feeling kind of angry and down or something, I might feel like that. But I kind of always grew up as a other kind of person. I was never fitting in, you know, and at first it bothered me. And then I realized that over time and when I got older and got to be an old lady, I realized that it's a special thing. When you say somebody's weird, the word weird means enchanted. So if you're enchanted, and I think I've been very fortunate. I really had a neat childhood. I mean, okay, maybe school wasn't great. I didn't fit in, but I used to just run away, you know. And I found something that I like to do, that I'm born to do, which is to be an artist one way or another. And not everybody finds what it is
not
they're meant to do.
Not everybody gets there. Mm-hmm.
And if you find out or you know what you're meant to do, be doing, then I feel you have an obligation to the creator or whoever your person upstairs is to fulfill that calling. And if you don't, you're committing a kind of sin against yourself and you'll not be happy. And if you put it off, you know, if you put it off, you might never get to do it, because if you always are, you know, and I suppose this sounds really airy-fairy, and people say, you know, you got to pay the bills and got to do stuff like that, which is true. But you can't give that up. I mean, the paying the bills part should be the minor part of your life. You should follow your bliss. That's what Joseph Campbell says. You follow your bliss, and it's amazing. You'll be much happier than if you're gruntling away, making a huge amount of money. But if you're not doing what you love to do, money can't get you happiness. Might get you a better bed or something like that. But, you know, it'll happen, you know, it'll happen. I just feel I've been blessed.
How do you think the world is treating young artists today? Do you think it's harder than it was for you? Or what advice would you have for a young artist?
Well, more or less just what I said. But in the commercial world and making your way, it's hard to say because I'm not in with a, you know, the huge $60,000, $70,000 people yet. But I think that I remember reading a book. It was a diary by Leonardo da Vinci. And he said that if you're an artist and you have to work to support yourself, you shouldn't do your art to earn work. Hmm. Work is what you love doing. But a job is what earns you money. So if you have to get a job, you should get a job that is divorced from art. In other words, being an art teacher is good if you really want to import your art to kids. But if it's just a means to an end to get money so you can paint, it won't work because it'll distort your art. It can, you know, or be a commercial artist or this. He said, people who are artists that need money should do something physical rather than intellectual, and they should do something working with their hands in terms of maybe digging the ground and being a, you know, worker, or something that doesn't interfere, that they can do automatically that doesn't interfere with their art. Because if you do something that's parallel to an art thing, his theory was that it will contaminate it, and you won't be able to be true to yourself, because you will have that.
It becomes distorted because you're sort of
having to
aimed at the marketplace instead of doing it from your heart.
That's right.
It is a danger, I think.
You know,
even in writing or anything,
you can. I mean, I don't know, because I'm not a writer yet. But if you were, you know, if you go into journalism, the journalism is going to affect how you write a story, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So, I think you have to be very careful, and you need a patron, you know, or a wealthy wife or a wealthy husband that believes in you. Or you just need not to have everything. You don't need three beds. You can sleep in one bed. You don't need that many houses. You can have one house or a roof over your head, you know, food in your stomach and enough money to pay for the paints. Let's keep it simple, you know.
So getting back to your book, The Tangerine Cat, we're aiming for, you know, between September and November. But in the meantime, you're offering people the opportunity to buy advanced copies.
Yes,
and you're going to be doing it at the May show.
Yeah, I've been selling them like hotcakes.
There you go.
I have forms and my phone number, 678-3049, area code 613. And I have email address is croneofthehill@hotmail.com, crone as in old lady. And people can contact me if they're sincere about ordering a book, and they come to the house, and I'll.
And I was just thinking,
I'll take their money.
Just thinking, doing planning on the air here. You should leave some of those forms here at the review. People are coming in, then you know, then people wouldn't be bothering you at your house, or you might not be there. But you could just tell them we're here.
Yeah,
you know, every day 9 to 5.
That's a good idea, because at the house, you know, if I don't hear the door, if I'm painting, I'm not going to answer the door. You know, but
boy,
anyways,
I wish I could say that. If I'm writing, I'm not going to answer the door.
Well, you don't hear it, right? So what I have the forms to fill out is to get your name and address and how many books you want and whether you've paid or not. And when you pay, I give you a receipt so that you can show me that you've paid, and I'm not going to ask you twice. But I just need to know who the book is for and how to get a hold of you. So I need your address and your postal address and et cetera, that kind of thing. And I'm going to have them at my house during the May show.
Right.
Because I'll have my exhibition on, and I'll have, depending which pictures I choose to go in the book, I'm going to have some illustrations in the book grayscaled. I may put up a couple of the paintings that are going to be in the book, which I thought would be kind of fun,
mm-hmm.
you know. It depends.
And so at the May show, which is coming up on May, is it 21 and 22 this year, I think?
That's right.
And you're going to have some of your work there. And what other artists will you have showing works?
I'll have two artists from Val David, Robin Hutchison, who is a potter and does very kind of beautiful raku and runs classes. She's an excellent person. And Maggie Rodden, who does ceramics, which is like sculptures, you know, like she does like giant sunflowers that are bird baths with a crow in them, and she does like ceramic stools that you can actually sit on, and they're all bright colors and they're just wonderful, you know, and little rooms. And I'm having a new person, Marie Dumais from Rigaud, and she's a landscape architect, and she calls them nature sculptures, and she takes all the bits and pieces of the places she's landscaped, like the roots and the branches, and she's going to have a couple of her big horses. They're like 6 feet by 8 feet.
Oh, I think I saw a couple of those at Lachenaie this week.
That's right.
They are amazing.
They're going to be
huge.
Up here on my front terrace looking down the road. So that's going to be fun. And then she also she's going to have some of her little horses. And they're going to be made out of plaster and straw, which is sort of how we used to make the walls of our houses in the olden days. Mm-hmm. So she's going to have about 10 of those, and she's going to have about 2 or 3 of the big horses at the front of the house. And they're for sale, too.
That's great. So that will be May 21st and 22nd. You can mm-hmm. take in a lot of art. You get to walk through Susan Jeffcott's downstairs of her house.
Not through the whole house.
Not
though.
The whole, just the part that's open with the art. And
that's
then you
right.
get to pre-order one of your books called The Tangerine Cat.
That's right. Almost true stories.
Right. So thanks for coming in to tell us all about that and sharing that really precious insight into color and painting, and that was really, really interesting. I can't wait to go somewhere and close my eyes and start moving colors around. And if anyone needs any more information about The Tangerine Cat, they can get in touch with us at The Review. They can look for Susan on Facebook and come to Van Cleek Hill for the May show, and you'll get to meet her in person. Thank you for coming in.
It was a pleasure.